All right. Good morning, everybody. Today is Friday, April 6th, 2018. And this says Before the First Cup of Jules here on UCY.TV. Happy Friday, everyone. It is a chilly 33 degrees and lightly snowing and gray here in upstate New York. This week we had vacation for the kids, so it's been kind of hairy this week. I spent the last couple days out helping Pops get some trees cut down that came down in the last big storm. But I just saw them talking in chat, and we had the same thing on Tuesday. Not only did we have snow, but we had 70-mile-an-hour peak gusts come through this region earlier this week. And now they're talking about another 40-mile-an-hour winds and more snow and freezing rain and crap tonight. I mean, this is April, guys. This isn't winter. Another big Arctic blast. So where do we leave off on last Friday? We titled the show Space IoT, DARPA, Swarms, AI, Robots, Teeth, Sensors, Fish Spy, and Nano BCI. And that sounds like a lot of stuff. We covered a lot of crazy things, lots of sensors and mad science gone man, getting things into your body to be able to bag, tag, and track. Now, I think earlier last week, we had discussed a story that Camille had sent me out of MIT Technology Review that talked about a new startup company that was going to work on digitizing the brain, and it was 100% fatal. It was for people who were chronically ill, and it was almost like an assisted suicide. They would put something into your IV that then, and I don't remember exactly what it did, it put some sort of chemical into your brain to be able to lock everything into place. So then once you were gone, I think they were going to freeze it and bomb it, and then freeze it, and then slice it into really thin slices and image it. So in the hopes that someday in the future, they might be able to bring you back. Well, there was an update to that story during the week that I wanted to cover today. We're going to look a lot at brains, which is one of our favorite topics, and some of the crazy stuff that they are working on, modifying biology. MIT, who was working with this company called Netcomb, MIT now cuts ties, this is April 4th, 2018, with company promising to provide digital immortality after killing you, because it was 100% fatal. Remember Netcomb, the startup that we posted about that, quote, promises to preserve your brain for uploading after they kill you? Well, apparently Netcomb has provided $300,000 of federal grant that it received to neuroscientist Ed Boyden's MIT laboratory to do some basic research that the company hoped that they could potentially apply to their wild project. They had already received $200,000 in deposits from people wanting to preserve their brains after the assisted suicide. Well, guess what? The scientific community called bullshit on Netcomb's proposition and raised serious ethical concerns about their approach. So it wasn't just us. So now the MIT Media Lab and Boyden has terminated their contract with Netcomb. And here is MIT's fascinating statement on the matter. The statement regarding the relationship between MIT Media Lab and Netcomb. In response to questions being raised about the relationship of Professor Ed Boyden and MIT with the company Netcomb. Netcomb is what it is. The MIT Media Lab is releasing the following statement. MIT is party to a subcontract under the National Institute of Mental Health Small Business Grant, so it's good old Tommy Incel's old alma mater, awarded to Netcomb, with the Boyden Group working on an academic research project to combine aspects of Netcomb's chemistry with Boyden's group's innovations, expansion microscopy to better visualize mouse brain circuits for basic science and research purposes. Now, if you remember MIT Media Lab, it's where they've been working on a lot of the robotics. That's where that first emotional robot that had the facial expressions came from. Such a novel chemistry could, if achieved, facilitate brain disorder drug discovery, and we're going to look at some of that today. Boost basic neuroscience circuit mapping, we're going to look at some of that as well. and facilitate brain banking for future research into health and to disease states. Professor Boyden has no personal affiliation, financial, operational, or contractual with the company Nectome. So MIT is putting Nectome at the end of their fist and dangling them way out there saying, we don't really know you. We just kind of talked about it. And upon consideration of the scientific premises underlying the company's commercial plans, as well as certain public statements that the company has made, MIT has informed Nectome of its intent to terminate the subcontract between MIT and Nectome in accordance with the terms of their agreement. Neuroscience has not sufficiently advanced to the point where we know whether or not any brain preservation method is powerful enough to preserve all the kinds of different biomolecules related to memory and the mind. It is also not known whether it is possible to recreate a person's consciousness. We're going to look at some of that later, too, if we can get there. And there is now more detail. Regarding the first point, it is not known what the exact kinds of biomolecules are that must be preserved to preserve memories and other information related to the mind, because remember they were talking about uploading the brain after death. And given that we do not know the exact set of molecules required, we cannot say whether a given brain preservation technique is sufficient to preserve all of the biomolecular detail required to preserve memories and other information related to the mind. This is a very interesting basic science question, and one that we hope that MIT can contribute to, but ultimately, much more science is needed. So step right up, pay your $100,000 or whatever it is to upload yourself someday in the future and hope that the technology is there when they try to defrost you. If someday we can measure the location and the identity of enough biomolecule types through the neural circuits and then discover that stimulating those things in concert is sufficient to recapitulate a brain's function, that would be extremely interesting and exciting to be sure, but this has not been done yet. And like any fundamental science question, there is no guarantee that it is possible at all. So they are removing themselves from the mad brain science category at the moment, it sounds like to me. And regarding the second point, currently, we cannot directly measure or create consciousness yet. And given that limitation, how can one say if, for example, a computer or a simulation is conscious? It's possible that someday we will be able to simulate in a computer neural circuits with great accuracy, and they are working on that. We've read about that before, based on detail enough biomolecular maps, but currently we do not know how to determine what such a simulation, even if scaled up to the size of the human brain, would feel like. To understand this would require new science that represents non-linear jumps from neuroscience occurring today, and some people regard this as an unsolvable problem, and that would be the hard problem of consciousness. Well, we had talked a little bit about DARPA last Friday wanting to extend the golden hour between life and death and slow life to save you with a biostasis program. When troops are wounded, time is precious, and that is why the fast ticking minutes that follow such an event are called the golden hour. Get the right care within the right time and you survive. Get the wrong care or an evac takes too long and you are dead. And that just reminds me, we had a really good friend this week end up in the hospital with the flu. And I feel pretty bad about it because we knew he was sick and we should have taken him to the hospital, but he didn't want to go. And then I had one of my friends go check on him and he was in pretty bad shape. So now he is in the hospital and we got him within that golden hour. I actually talked to him right before the show and he sounds a lot better than he did yesterday. But that is true. You have that little window when things start to go bad. And when you go bad, it's a downward spiral from there, especially if you have nobody there to make sure you are okay. Well, thank goodness, because researchers at the Defense Advanced Research Project Agency, more affectionately known as DARPA, have recently launched a 5-year project dubbed Biostasis. We had looked at some of that in regards to Gabby Giffords. We had mentioned her many times, and her story has come up a lot of times, especially with all the mass shootings going on. Gabby Giffords was saved by putting her into a type of stasis by using cooled saline into her bloodstream to bring her body temperature down so her biological processes slowed down that would limit the brain damage. The program will leverage molecular biology to develop innovative ways of controlling the speed at which living systems operate. Remember, DARPA was also working on a program to control biological systems and biological groups of systems. This, I think, is a part of that program as well. They're trying to crack all the codes of biology to be able to figure out how to control it and then manipulate it. And by doing that, they hope to extend the quote-unquote golden hour before it is too late. At the molecular level, life is a set of continuous biochemical reactions, and it is a defining characteristic of those reactions that they need a catalyst to occur at all. And those catalysts are proteins, and we're going to look at proteins a lot today, and large molecular machines, like Eric Drexler talked about with nanotechnology, they transform chemical and kinetic energy into the biological processes. Our goal with biostasis is to control those molecular machines and to get them to slow their roll about the same rate so we can get them to slow down the entire system gracefully, like a UPS for doing a graceful shutdown on a PC in a power outage, to avoid adverse consequences when the intervention is reversed or wear off. The program starts small, first aiming at slowing certain processes within cells, and then slowing whole cells, and then later tissue processes, and then onto an entire organism. But the goal isn't simply to slow down processes, but also to do it without damaging the processes when they return to normal, and our treatment needs to hit every single cellular process at close to the same rate, and then with the same potency and efficacy. We cannot treat focus problems to interrupt just a subset of critical processes, and the wrong kind of slowdown, well, it might be bad, and in the wrong sequence or at different rates could actually kill a cell. So to avoid these problems, DARPA wants to put their efforts on a protein level, ding-a-ling-a-ling, and they are looking to nature for some clues. Certain creatures such as the tardigrades, and that's where we ended a show last week, and the wood frogs can go into a state known as cryptobiosis, where it seems like all their metabolic processes have stopped, but they actually are still alive, according to the DARPA release. Tardigrades, and we have read about them a long time ago, they can actually survive in space and at sub-freezing temperatures, which are microscopic invertebrates can use this adaptation to survive freezing, extreme radiation, and near total dehydration. Wood frogs use the same method to survive freezing solid for multiple days, and we are now using nature as a source of inspiration, which seems to be the way that all this mad science gone mad is spinning out of biology. And if we can figure out the best ways to bolster other biological systems and make them less likely to enter a runaway downward spiral after being damaged, then we will have made significant additions to the biology toolbox. That's a key word. The biostasis program's goals are to build proof of concept technologies and then test them in simple living organisms. And then we're going to move on to more complex ones, and we will work and the work will include federal health and regulatory agencies to then develop a pathway for future human medical use. So you will actually become the guinea pig. Well, part of a lot of what has been going on here, of course, is this brain initiative. And that's where they were talking about the National Institute of Health. They got a large chunk of dollars out of the Obama Brain Initiative that rolled out back, I think it was in 2016. One of the things that they've been working on is the Connectome Project. And some of that, Nectome was part of this Connectome Project, where they were able to map neurons in very high resolution to be able to reconstruct them in the future. Here's a story out of newatlas.com, April 3rd, 2018. The Connectome, which is the physical map of personality and the rise of high-res cryonics. Now, that's another technology that we are finding a lot in this longevity quest for immortality. Future is cryonics, freezing the millionaires who can afford it to be frozen for thousands of years until the cures for what ailed them appear. What is the essence of a person? Well, it is a deep question for a Tuesday. This must have been this week, Tuesday. While almost nothing is known about consciousness itself, science has opened some tiny doors into how the brain functions. And whether you are a biological essentialist who believes that the entirety of consciousness is embedded in the meatware of the brain, or some kind of spiritualist that sees consciousness as something separate and not of this plane that drives, observes, and works the brain, it is clear that the brain is responsible for the ton of stuff that makes you who you are. Memories, for example, muscle memories too, thinking patterns that become more and well-worn over time until they are a default, connections between things and functional representations of things, concepts, ideas, and people, whether there is a soul or a spirit or a separate consciousness involved or not, these memories and connections do seem to exist at a physical level in the brain. But whatever exists at a physical level, transhumanists would say, can be preserved after death and then reanimated at some point or in some form. Yeah, just not by Nectome, apparently. Hence the field of cryonics, in which bodies or just brains are frozen after death to preserve as much of this precious thinking tissue as possible in the hopes that individuals can one day be brought back to life. But what physical structures exactly are we trying to preserve, and do current cryonic techniques actually preserve it? Well, the connectome is, in essence, a wiring diagram of the brain. It is a physical map of all the neurons in the brain, or indeed the whole nervous system, and the synaptic connections between them. And this is something that we can actually physically see, though certain different imaging techniques work at different ranges of scale. Take a cube brain slice and then slice it finely enough to create a 3D model of the cube, and you begin to see the staggering physical complexity that even the simplest invertebrates' brains require. And at the macro scale, thick neuronal branches curl around and intertwine with countless others, and the shapes are endlessly complex. So imagine a densely packed bowl of spaghetti, but with each strand varying its shape, thickness, and 3D geometry all the way down to accommodate other strands and connect them with multiple times. And the further you zoom in, the more complex things become, and as smaller and smaller neurons branch off from larger ones, connect to all the other sizes and at specific points called synapses, where information can be exchanged in the form of neurotransmitters, which are chemicals, and electrical impulses. It is a colossal oversimplification, but the theory is that each of these pathways, with all their touch points, branches, and connections with other pathways, may actually represent a thought, memory, or action. And the more you do it or think it, the larger and the thicker that pathway becomes. The more you learn about it, the more physical connections it forms with other neurons and processes, further building your map of understanding. Thus, the map brain changes over time, constantly reinforcing some pathways as others are left to die from disuse. And we might indeed be prisoners, in a sense, of our connectomes, and that they determine exactly what thought patterns will come out of each situation. But so that's that nature versus nurture argument coming to fruition. But by the mere act of thought itself, we have the ability to rewire ourselves to a significant degree, and that's called plasticity, to enlarge some pathways and allow others to drop off. And the more you think or do something, the more a physical part of your brain it becomes. And it is just as possible to let parts of your brain atrophy if you ignore them. And that's like during school when you were a kid. If you would go for your entire summer vacation and not read a book, that's exactly what would happen. Because when you got back to school, your brain felt a little bit rusty. That's actually what happens to me when I go a couple days without doing a show. I feel a little atrophied. And while we have literally no idea how to separate function out from these infinitely complex forms, it appears to be a physical manifestation of how we believe things like memory, behavior, personality, and understanding might work. In theory, if you could completely map the connectome of an individual and understand which bits did what, then you could build a complete model predicting what a person would think, say, and do in a given set of circumstances. Let them get some good 3D high-resolution scanning technology and let them crack all those codes, and they'll be able to make a digital representation where they can then model or simulate everything they know about you and probably predict your next move. At the moment, it is possible through the use of different types of MRI imaging, which would be the fMRI and diffusal MRI, to map some of this stuff at a macro level in living subjects. And remember, last week we also talked about that new wearable MRI where you can get up and move around and it can do live scans. And this is already starting to help us understand certain behaviors and phenomenon. Researchers are trying to use diffusional MRI mapping to trace things how like depression and anxiety disorders disrupt healthy brain functions. And remember, this is all in the name of mental health. These advantages of live mapping are clear. You can get the subject to do or think things and then track what their brain activity does and then use that to build some idea of the functions of each of the areas you can distinguish. But while MRI imaging in live subjects is more likely to be useful in the short term, the technology is far too low resolution, well, some of the new ones aren't, to reach the ultimate goal of full human connectome mapping, which is the end goal of all of this. MRIs can highlight the brain superhighways, but it can get down to the level of back roads and walking trails. And to get to the cellular level, which is the real end goal of all of this, which it does say is the ultimate goal, you currently need a dead patient. And those whose brains you can chop into small blocks, yeah, just like that 100% fatal embalming thing with Nectome, and then slice those blocks and analyze them with light and electron microscopes, stains, and other tools in order to recreate high-resolution maps that allow researchers to trace, mark, and depict every natural neural pathway and synaptic connection in 3D. To call these complex maps is another colossal understatement. When researchers fully modeled the connectome of the C. elegans worm, which is where they do a lot of their research, because that worm has a lot of things that are very similar to humans, which has only 302 neurons to trace, they ended up needing 12 terabytes of data just to store it. The map of the human brain would be more in the order of 2 million terabytes. And that is purely to describe just its physical structure. If you wanted to build a functioning model of a person inside of some ultra computer at some point in the future, you'd most likely need to know what the hell each of those pathways does in a functional sense. And let's not forget either just how much of that spaghetti tangle of neurons deals with phenomenon specific to the body that the brain is in. And because it connects to all kinds of physical stems and subsystems, from sensory inputs to unconscious reaction circuits to hormone secretions, motor impulses, and background organ regulation, reconstruction of the connectome of the brain without all of the other bits, goodness knows what the system would be able to function when so much of the body and input mechanisms are gone. Well, as part of that 2045 project, that's what they were talking about, putting brains into a tin can and being able to wire them up. And one of the things we had looked at, and maybe we're going to get there today, were some of the things that they were discovering with mini brains that they were growing with those iPS stem cells and then implanting them into mousies. And they had all the nerves and the central nervous systems, and the vasculature was growing to absorb these mini brains and make them a part of the body. So who knows, maybe they could even reanimate a corpse with your mini brain that they were growing in a petri dish waiting for you to kick the bucket. And assuming even that this gargantuan set of infinitely complex and connected problems can be solved, and you could run the model yourself in a computer, a model of yourself at a specific date and time, of course, because neuroplasticity ensures that you is a constantly evolving concept, there remains a question of whether that model could be said to be alive, or even if it has consciousness, or if it is merely able to do a really good impression of you. But if it does seem plausible that this type of technique applied correctly to a preserved brain many years after death could be used to extract memories and personality and behavior patterns that could give subjects some legitimate claim to immortality. And if a person is something like an idea, and an idea can be propagated forward through different substrates, perhaps your personality can be too. And it is certainly cool to think about uploading your personality into some 30-foot-tall, rocket-powered Godzilla robot. Ding, ding, ding! And that's what the military hopes for in the future. And as we move forward, we learn more and more about how much we don't know. And while brain science has progressed at a similarly astronomical rate to other sciences, it is a subject of immense complexity that is likely that the human brain literally is not smart enough to understand its own workings. And I think that is by design, because it makes us dangerous. And the known unknowns continue to pile up, and it seems that we will have to rely on machines and software that can think faster and in more dimensions than we can in order to untangle the comically gigantic mystery of the connectome. But one thing seems clear: if we're going to persist with the business of cryonics, and that would be freezing brains or whole bodies in the hope of resurrecting them someday, we need to make sure that we are preserving them in a way that supports the reconstruction or the mapping of the connectome at the highest possible resolutions. All right, let's go on to the next tab, because then they're going to talk about all the different chemicals that they can pump into the brain to do that. And I don't really care about the exact chemicals. So here, this is just the other day, April 4th, 2018, out of quantummagazine.org. New brain maps with unmatched detail may change neuroscience. And every day there is a new discovery. A technique based on something that we have read about is a project that Georgie Porgy Church was working on with IARPA, which was the DARPA of the intelligence agencies, which would be genetic barcoding of neurons. A new technique based on genetic barcoding can easily map the connections of individual brain cells in unprecedented numbers. Unexpected complexity in the visual system is only the very first secret that it has revealed. And what's interesting about the visual system is that that is how artificial intelligence has taken leaps and bounds forward. Is once they gave computers GPUs, and that would be graphical processing units, and video was the first biggie, to be able to allow them to see and analyze images. That has led to a lot of the exponential progress in AI. Well, sitting at a desk in his lower campus office at Cold Spring Harbor Laboratory, neuroscientist Tony Zador turned his computer monitor off to show me, or turned it toward me to show off a complicated matrix-style graph. Imagine something that looks like a spreadsheet, but instead of numbers, it is filled with colors of varying hues and gradations. Casually, he says, when I tell people I figured out the connectivity of tens of thousands of neurons and then show them this, they just go, huh. But when I show this to people and he clicks on a button and a transparent 3D model of the brain pops up spinning on its axis, filled with nodes and lines, too numerous to count, they go, what the F? So what Zader showed me was a map of 50,000 neurons in the cerebral cortex of a mouse, and it indicates where the cell bodies of every neuron sat and where they sent along their long axonal branches. A neural map on this size and detailed has never been made before. foregoing the traditional method of brain mapping that involves marking neurons with fluorescence. There was something else that George Church was working on. Zadar had taken an unusual approach that drew on long traditions of molecular biology research, and he used bits of genomic information to imbue a unique RNA sequence or barcode onto each individual neuron. Then he dissected the brain into cubes like a sheet cake. Oh, that's a horrible thought. And fed the pieces into a DNA sequencer. And the result was a 3D rendering of 50,000 neurons in a mouse cortex, with many more to be added soon, that were mapped with single-cell resolution. This work is still being refined for publication, but in a paper recently published by Nature, he and his colleagues showed that a technique called MAPSEQ, which is M-A-P-S-E-Q, which is multiplexed analysis of projections by sequencing, can be used to find new cell types and projection patterns like never observed before. The paper also demonstrates that this new high-throughput mapping method is strongly competitive in accuracy with the fluorescent techniques, which is the current gold standard, but works best with small numbers of neurons. The project was born from Zadar's frustration during his day job as a neurophysiologist, and he studies auditory decision-making in rodents, and that would be how their brain hears sounds, processes audio information, and then determines behavioral outputs or actions. And that's pretty interesting that he's finding a way to manipulate behavior in mice with sounds. Electrophysiological recordings and other traditional tools for addressing such questions left the mathematically inclined scientist unsatisfied. And the problem, according to Zadar, is that we do not understand enough about the circuitry of neurons, which is the reason he now pursues his new ambition, which would be creating tools for imaging the brain. If we ever wanted to know how a mouse hears high-pitched trills, processes that mean sounds that process the sound means a refreshing drink reward is available when they hear the sound, and then it lays down new memories to recall to treat later, and we will need to start with mapping a wiring diagram for the brain. So this is using sounds to then enable them to know that they will get a reward of a drink if they interact. That's pretty frightening. Let's beam out a couple 432 gigahertz beams and make people go reach for the mouse and do a search. I don't know, guys. It's pretty crazy. In Zadar's view, lack of knowledge about what kind of neural circuitry is partially to blame for why more progress has not been made in the treatment of psychiatric disorders and why artificial intelligence is still not all that intelligent, right? Because they're mapping the brain to create better artificial intelligence. The inspiration for MAPSEQ struck Zadar when he learned of another brain mapping technique called BrainBow, hailing from the lab of Jeff Lichtman at Harvard University. This method was remarkable in that it genetically labeled up to 200 individual neurons simultaneously using different combinations of fluorescent dyes. And I think this is some of the stuff that Church was helping on. The result was tantalizing, and multicolored tableaus of neon-colored neurons that displayed in detail a complex intermingling of axons and neuron cell bodies. The groundbreaking work gave hope that mapping of the connectome, which is the complete plan of neural connections in the brain, was soon to be a reality. But unfortunately, the limitations of the technique in that practice is that through a microscope, experimenters could resolve only about 5 or 10 colors, which was not enough to penetrate the tangle of neurons in the cortex and map many neurons at once. So that's when the light bulb went off in his head, and he realized that the challenge of the connectome might be tamed if researchers could harness the increasing speed and the dwindling cost of high-throughput genetic sequencing techniques. And that's what mathematicians call reducing it to a previously solved problem. So researchers inject animals with genetically modified viruses, probably adenoviruses, that carry a variety of known RNA sequences or barcodes, And for a week or more, the viruses then multiply inside of the animal, filling each of their neurons with some distinctive combination of those barcodes. When the researchers then retrieve that brain and cut it into little tiny sections, the RNA barcodes can then help them track individual neurons from slide to slide. Zador's insight led to a new Nature paper in which his lab and a team at the University College London that led neuroscientist Thomas Miskfogel to use MapSec to trace the projections of almost 600 neurons in a mouse. And 600 neurons is a modest start compared with the tens of millions that a mouse actually has. But it was ample for the specific purpose to research the mind, and they were looking to discern whether or not there is a structure to the brain's wiring pattern that might be informative about its function. The current popular theory is that the visual cortex, which is an individual neuron, gathers at a specific bit of information from the eye about the edge of an object and the field of view or the type of movement or the spatial orientation, for example, and then the neuron sends that signal to a single corresponding area in the brain that specializes in that type of information. So the results suggest that visual systems contain a dizzying level of cross-connectivity, and patterns for those connections are more complicated than one-to-one mapping. Higher visual areas don't just get information that are specifically tailored to them. They share many inputs, so their computation might be tied to each other. In other words, it is extremely damn complex. So now let's bounce over. I was getting a little technical. Some of the other things we're doing, they've talked about mini brains and growing mini brain balls. We've covered three or four different stories about them now. The creepiest brain balls yet that were brewed up for a year in a petri dish made from iPS stem cells that are mixed up with some chemicals to create stem cells that then they turn into brains and then let them grow. And as they grow, they differentiate their different cell types. Well, guess what? Mini brains, this is April 3rd, 2018, out of Wired.com. Mini brains just got creepier, and they're actually growing their own veins. The first human brain balls, a.k.a. cortical spheroids, a.k.a. neural organoids, agglomerated into existence just a few short years ago. In the beginning, they were almost chemically crude, just plain stem cells chemically coerced into proto-neurons and then swirled into blobs in a salty sweet bath. It sounds pretty yucky. But still, they were useful for studying some of the most dramatic brain disorders like microencephaly caused by the Zika virus, right? Which I think that whole Zika virus scare was all a part of giving them candidates that they'll be able to study in the future. But then they started growing up, and these little mini brain balls matured into 3D structures, fusing with other types of brain balls and sparking with electricity. Well, the more like real brains they became, the more useful they were for studying complex behaviors and neurological diseases beyond the reach of animal models. And now, in their most human act yet, they are actually starting to bleed. Oh, neural organoids, more affectionately known as mini brain balls, don't yet even remotely resemble adult brains. Developmentally, they are just pushing second trimester tissue organization. But the way Ben Waldo sees it, brain balls might be the best chance that his stroke patients have at making a full recovery. And remember, they keep aiming this at stroke patients to cure them after a neurological vascular event. And a homegrown blood supply is a big step toward that far-off goal. A blood supply carries oxygen and nutrients, allowing brain balls to grow bigger, complex neural networks of tissues, those that a doctor could then someday use to shore up malfunctioning neurons in a stroke patient. The whole idea with these organoids is to one day be able to develop brain structures that the patient has lost, made with the patient's own stem cells. says Waldo, who is a vascular neurosurgeon at UC Davis Medical Center. And that's where they're working on CRISPR as well with Jennifer Doudna. We see the injuries still there on CAT scans, but there is nothing we can do. So many of them are left behind with permanent neural deficits, paralysis, numbness, weakness, even after surgery and physical therapy. Well, last week, it was Waldo's group at UC Davis that published the first results of vascularized human neural organoids. Using brain membrane cells taken from one of his patients during routine surgery, the team coaxed the first of them into stem cells, and then some of them into endothelial cells that line the blood vessels insides. The stem cells they grew into brain balls, which then they incubated in a gel mix coated with endothelial cells. And after incubating for 3 weeks, they took a single organoid and transplanted it into a tiny cavity carefully carved into a little mousey's brain. And 2 weeks later, the organoid was alive, well, and critically had grown capillaries that penetrated all the way to its inner layers. So to back up, they said that they carved a cavity into a mouse's brain. We had read about some really messed up research they were doing a while back, creating chimeras from one brain and putting another living creature's cells inside of a brain to create two organisms from two different organisms in one living creature. That's what that sounds like. They're creating human mini brains and then putting them inside of a mouse brain. 2 weeks later, the organoids are alive and well, and they've grown capillaries that penetrated all the way into its inner layers. Waldo got the idea from his work treating a weird, rare disorder called Moyamoya's disease. Patients have blocked arteries at the base of their brain, keeping blood from reaching the rest of the organ. And sometimes we lay a patient's own arteries on top of the brain to get blood vessels to start growing in. But when we replicated the process on a miniaturized scale, we actually saw the vessels self-assemble. Well, it wasn't clear from this experiment whether or not there was rodent blood coursing through the capillaries. The scientists had to flush them to accomplish fluorescent staining. The UC Davis team did demonstrate that blood vessels themselves were comprised of human cells. And the other research groups at the Salk Institute and the University of Pennsylvania have also successfully transplanted human organoids into the brains of mice, but in both cases, blood vessels from the rodent spontaneously grew into the transplant tissue. This is the first time that they had blood vessels from humans grow into the human organoid inside of the mouse. When the brain balls make their own blood vessels, they can potentially live much longer by hooking them up to microfluidic pumps, and no rodent is required. So that would be something like in a petri dish or in a brain on a chip, like we had talked about last week, where they're making brains and bodies on a chip with little microfluidic pumps inside of these little chips. That might give them a chance to actually mature into a complex computational organ, and it is a big deal, says Christoph Cook, president of, yes, Paul Allen's Allen Institute for Brain Science in Seattle. But this is still in its very early days. The next problem will be getting these cells wired into circuits that can receive and process information. This is going to be Jabba the Hutt one day, sitting in a laboratory. And the fact that I can look out at the world and see it as spatially organized, left, right, near, far, it is all due to the organization of my cortex that reflects the regularity of the world. There is nothing like that yet in these organoids. Not yet, but maybe it is not too soon to start asking what happens when these little brain organoids do get a layout of the land, and when they get consciousness, and how large do they have to get before society has a moral mandate to provide them with some sort of special protection or maybe even rights. If an organoid comes from your cells, then are you its legal guardian? And can a brain ball give its consent to be studied? Well, those are all very good questions there. But last week at the National Institute of Health, they convened a neuroethics workshop to work out some of these thorny questions. And addressing a room filled with neuroscientists, doctors, and philosophers, Walter Korsesh, director of the National Institute of Health's National Institute of Neurological Disorders and Stroke, said that it was time to involve the public, and that was now, even if this technology takes a century to become a reality. Right, they probably want people to become part of their cohort program and step right up for life-saving cures. When you are desperate in the hospital, they're going to have some sort of clinical trial. And the question is, as these cells come together to form information processing units, when do they get to the point where they are as good as what we have now in a mouse? And when it goes beyond that point, information processing, you only see a human. What type of information processing would be to a point where you say, well, I don't think we should go there? And of course, that assumes that neuroscientists would be able to recognize consciousness in an organoid if they saw it. Biology has yet to settle on the theory of consciousness in humans, let alone measure it in balls of brain cells, because after all, a brain isn't really a brain until it has experience. And remember, it needs to be able to see and have the five senses to be able to tell what is going on around it. Because after all, a brain really isn't a brain until it has experience. And you can have all the right wires and connections, but until it is hooked up to some kind of input, it can't process anything. Blood vessels are a very good start, but we won't start worrying about consciousness until the brain balls have little eyes. And I'm going to add to that, in one of the original stories that we had read about mini brain balls, I thought that we had read that as the cells started to differentiate for about a year in a petri dish, they had discovered that they were starting to form olfactory cells, and those would be the cells that allow it to smell, and hence one of the five senses. So I guess we're not going to get to proteins today. This might be next week that I'll have to save these for. We're going to jump a little bit into consciousness because there were a few stories that came out last week or the week before, but some of these new studies that they are working on from signal propagation to consciousness in the brain. March 22nd, 2018, New York University out of medicalexpress.com. From signal propagation to consciousness, new findings point to a potential connection. Researchers at NYU have discovered a novel mechanism through which information can be effectively transmitted across many areas of the brain, a finding that offers a potentially new way of understanding how consciousness arises. The brain areas tend to be organized in an hierarchy ranging from lower sensory areas to higher cognitive areas. And these areas have excitatory or inhibitory neurons, which either stimulate or suppress activity in other neurons. And that would be those flipping switches on and off. And understanding how neural signals are transmitted across this hierarchy is still a fundamental challenge in neuroscience and has served as the focal point for the study. Previous computer modeling of signal transmission across areas in the brain did not take into account the complexity of the brain's area-to-area connections. And by contrast, thanks to recent advances in the field of connectomics dedicated to quantitatively analyzing the brain's connectivity, NYU scientists were able to build models incorporating anatomical connectivity data of mock monkeys. And here's where they found that transmission signals on a large-scale model of a primate brain is robust under areas or conditions in which area-to-area connections exhibit a balance between excitation and inhibition. Specifically, stimulation provided by the excitatory neurons allows for signals to be transmitted, whereas suppression from inhibitory neurons makes the signal activity not go out of control. Notably, the global activation pattern resembles ones previously found in human brains while consciously perceiving sensory information. and now has given them an understanding how conscious information processing is achieved. And this one is out of ScienceDaily.com. Slow, steady waves keep the brain humming. And this is why we have to worry about a lot of this wireless technology and these higher frequencies that have never before been seen being beamed out ubiquitously into our environment, because we don't quite understand how things work, and our brain works on different frequencies for sending information. Slow and steady waves keep the brain humming. Such rhythmic waves are linked to the states of consciousness. March 29th, 2018, out of Washington University School of Medicine. Very slow brain waves, long considered an artifact of brain scanning techniques, may be more important than anyone has realized. Researchers have now found that very slow waves are directly linked to states of consciousness and may be involved in coordinating activity across distant brain regions. If you keep a close eye on an fMRI scan of the brain, you will see a wave pass through the entire brain like a heartbeat every few seconds. This ultra-slow rhythm was recognized decades ago, but no one quite knew what was to make of it, and the MRI data is inherently noisy, so researchers simply ignored the ultra-slow waves. But by studying electrical activity in mouse brains, researchers at the Washington University School of Medicine in St. Louis has found that the ultra-slow waves are anything but noise. They are more like waves in the sea. Everything that the brain does and has taking place in a boat upon the sea, and research to date has been focused on the goings-on inside of the boat without much thought to the sea itself. But this new information suggests that the waves play a central role in how the complex brain coordinates itself, and the waves are directly linked to your consciousness. Your brain has 100 billion neurons or so, and they all have to be coordinated. So these slowly varying signals in the brain are a way to get a very large-scale coordination of activities in all the diverse areas of the brain at the very same time. And when the wave goes up, areas become more excitable, and when they go down, they become inhibited. Using resting state networks, other researchers started searching for and finding brain areas that behave differently in healthy people than in people with brain diseases such as schizophrenia and Alzheimer's. And that's where we are going to kick off the very next show, is looking at some of the disruption in brain diseases and some of malformed proteins and the research that they have found. But even as the resting state MRI data has provided new insights into neuropsychiatric disorders, they are also consistently showing waves of activity spreading with slow regularity throughout the brain, independently of diseases in the study. Similar waves were seen in brain scans of monkeys as well as in rodents, and some researchers thought that these ultra-slow waves were more than just an artifact of the MRI itself. The MRI gauges the brain activity indirectly by measuring the flow of oxygen-rich blood over a period of seconds, but rather than this genuinely slow process, the reasoning went the waves could be the sum of many rapid electrical signals over a long period of time. What they have found, the waves are no artifacts. Ultra-slow waves were seen regardless of the technique, and they were not the sum of the faster electrical activity inside of the brain. Sorry, let's move one more step here. This is out of medicalexpress.com. Again, a heavy working memory load may sync your brainwave. Sync, C-Y-N-C-H. April 5th, 2018, out of MIT. Everyday experience makes it obvious, and sometimes frustratingly so. And that is that our working memory capacity is limited. And I run into this every morning before I go live, and I'm trying to do my cram session before the show and get all my stories lined up. We can only keep so many things consciously at one time in your mind, and recent study may explain why. It suggests that the coupling or synchrony of brainwaves among three key regions breaks down in specific ways when visual working memory loads become too much to handle. when you reach brain capacity, there is a loss of feedback coupling. And that loss of synchrony means that the regions can no longer communicate with each other to sustain a working memory. It means that you've stuffed your brain too full of ideas. Maximum working memory capacity, for instance, the total number of images a person can hold in working memory at the same time, varies by individual, but it averages about 4. And researchers have correlated working memory capacity with intelligence. Understanding what causes working memory to have an intrinsic limit is therefore important because it could help explain the limited nature of conscious thoughts and the optimal cognitive performance for humans. And because certain psychiatric disorders can lower that capacity, the findings could also explain more about how such disorders interfere with your thinking. The study's author is Tim Bushman, who's an assistant professor at Princeton. And his study is a detailed statistical analysis of data that shows that when animal subjects played a similar game, they had to spot the difference when they were shown a set of squares on a screen. And then after a brief blank screen, a nearly identical set had a color change. The number of squares involved were the same, hence the working memory load of each round varied so that sometimes the task exceeded the animal's capacity. Because the study game purposely varied where the squares appeared on the left or the right, it showed that people have independent capacities on their left and their right sides. And they're now working on a new study that tracks how these regions interact when working memory information must be shared across your visual field. The more scientists learn about how working memory works, and generally more about how brainwaves synchronize for higher cognitive functions, the more ways they'll be able to apply that knowledge to help people or maybe even wipe out memories at a distance. And if we can figure out what things rhythms are doing and how they are doing them and what they are doing and when they are doing them in the brain, we may be able to find ways to change those rhythms or strengthen them if they need to be strengthened. And very last but not least, hopefully I have my music on, electric wave engulfs the brain at the very first blush of consciousness. Our brains are bombarded with information around us, but we only become conscious of a few of them. Yale researchers have now put together a fundamental state of human life. And there's only a few milliseconds when we become aware and conscious.